We are going to continue on with our sermon series called To Cross Over. Today we're looking in depth at the life of Abram in the book of Genesis, and today we're going to be opening up Genesis chapter 14. So when we last saw Abram and Lot, if you recall in chapter 13, we know that Lot and Abram decided to part ways. Abram kind of gave Lot the option, and Lot said, you know what, we do need to split up. And Lot left Abram, left his clan, left the promised land, and settled near Sodom by the cities on the plain that looked alluring and exciting from a distance. And Abram stayed under the great trees of Mamre, which is where we'll find them today when we get to Genesis chapter 14. But something drastic happens at the beginning of chapter 14. There is quite a scene of kings and battles and things like that. And in the end, something happens that pushes or compels Abram to act. So we're going to talk today about how Abram goes on what I would call a rescue mission. That he has a mission in mind, and that mission is to rescue someone. So let's dig right into it. Genesis chapter 14, starting in verse 1, going all the way through verse 16. And I have to warn you today that there are quite a few stumble-worthy names in this section. So if I mispronounce them, if I stumble through them, if I don't pronounce them the same way two or three times, please forgive me. Even though it's actually English and not the original Hebrew, some of these names are still a little bit difficult, but we'll get through it together, and then we'll kind of summarize and leave the names out just to get a picture of what's happening here in this story. So starting in verse 1, at the time when Amraphel was king of Shinar and Arioch king of Elasar, and Kedorlaomer king of Elam and Tidal king of Goim, these kings went to war against Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemember, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zor. All these latter kings joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Dead Sea Valley. For 12 years they had been subject to Kedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Kedorlaomer and the kings allied with him went out and defeated the Rephaites in Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzites in Ham, the Emites in Shava, Kiri Athaim, and the Horites in the hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran near the desert. Then they turned back and went to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and they conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites, as well as the Amorites who were living in Hazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zor, marched out and drew up their battle lines in the valley of Siddim against Kedorlaomer, the king of Elam, Tidal, the king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and when the king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some of the men fell into them, and the rest fled to the hills. The four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and then they went away. They also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. A man who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Aner, all of whom were allied with Abram. And when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out to the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions together with the women and the other people. So, 100% honesty, I took the scripture. Usually I just have it in my actual sermon notes. I printed out on a separate sheet of paper with some phonetic spellings for some of those so that I would hopefully do them correctly and consistently. So, whew, we got through it together. That's all right. So there's a lot happening, right? We see a lot unfolding with allies and enemies, like this back and forth, these kings and who's on what side and what they're going to do together and who's going to pay for what. But one of the first things I thought of when I read this text during the week is I sat and I thought, man, this would make a phenomenal action movie. Wouldn't it? I mean, I'm picturing these gigantic battle scenes as this dominant military force moves through and there's swords and shields and archers and bows and arrows and all kinds of stuff happening, right? So you have these gigantic battle scenes. You have these heroic choices that need to be made by Abram. You have the family drama of, Lot walked away from Abram. Why should he go after him? So you have family drama tied into all of it. You have the political intrigue about these kings aligning with these and these being rebellious against these. And I mean, come on, there's tar pits involved. A battle scene with tar pits and people, it seems like a fantastic sequence of events for an action movie. A couple interesting things to note, this is actually the only story in the life of Abram where he leads a military-styled campaign. And secondly, this is the only chapter in Abram's story in Genesis in which God's voice is actually completely absent. If you notice in the chapter 14, God actually doesn't even speak. It's very rare. But as we turn to the story of nations against nations and kings against kings, these allies and enemies, I think what we can note on the surface is that if we think that this macro social behavior of nations, how nations interact with one another, choosing alliances and having common enemies, if we think that this is a new thing for our world today, we are drastically mistaken, right? It is something that's been going on forever. I think sometimes we look at the headlines and we react and go, oh, the world's falling apart. They're choosing sides here and there, and there's enemies here and there. But to borrow a phrase from a recent show that I saw, this is a tale as old as time, right? It really is. It's something that's been going on from the very beginning. Kings allied with other kings, deciding which other kings need to be subjugated to their rule. We don't have exact historical connections to all of the kings mentioned here in Genesis chapter 14, but that's of secondary importance. What's of primary importance is what we see playing out in the world of Genesis 14 is still playing out in our world today, which is another way of saying the Bible is just as relevant today as it was 1,000 or 2,000 or 4,000 years ago. Because there are some things about human nature that simply don't change. So to simplify what happens in the story, so we have a good background of information, to simplify and really to leave most of the awkward names out, here's pretty much what happens. There are four kings from the east, if you look at the map and how this all works out. The four kings from the east, led by Chedorlaomer, exercise rule over five western kings, right, including Sodom and Gomorrah's kings. So eastern kings ruling over western kings. And those western kings, therefore, had to pay a regular tribute to the eastern kings. And by tribute, we mean taxes. It's all about taxes, right? So they decided after like 12 years or so, they're tired of paying these tribute taxes to the eastern kings, and they decide they're going to rebel and not send their tribute. Now, from what we learn in the story, they probably waited until an opportune time when these eastern kings were busy with other matters. In the ancient world, that's how you would often do it. You would wait for the people who ruled over you to be busy with something else, and then you would stop paying your tribute in hopes that they would forget or maybe ignore the fact. And you can see it took a year for the eastern kings to respond. And so they say, we're not going to pay, and a year later, Chedorlaomer and his friends decide to punish the rebels. However, they don't go directly there. En route to this objective, they take a tour down what was called the King's Highway at the time. It's this very well-known pathway that was used for commerce and military matters during the day. They took basically a southward tour on this road, and they beat up on four other groups of people and took over two additional territories. Now, we don't know why. Was it just a warm-up exercise for the armies to kind of get their blood flowing? We don't know. Was it because they were trying to expand their rule on the way down? We don't know. Maybe they were just flexing their existing influence. Maybe those people were also already paying tribute to them. Or maybe, just maybe, they were hoping that these warm-up battles, the news of them would trickle to the rebels and they would hear about it. And so maybe begin to start quaking in their boots a little bit at the fact that these eastern kings were on the warpath. The rebels hear about this oncoming onslaught, and so they bravely or foolishly, depending on how you look at it, take up an offensive stance in that Dead Sea Valley. They kind of line up and say, here we are, let's go at this. And I don't think it took very long, based on the text, for them to be vanquished. There's really no details, except they started to run away pretty quickly. And when the eastern kings were done beating up on these rebellious western kings, we're told that they took some things with them. Plunder, essentially. They took goods and food, all the food, we're told, and also some people, including one very important person, and that is Lot, the nephew of Abram. Now, after we hear about the absolute dominance of this group of eastern kings, these armed forces, isn't it amazing to you, it is to me, that Abram would even attempt to go out against them, and that he would, in his attempt, be successful and emerge victorious? I mean, Abram has started to build up a stockpile of people. It says 318 armed men who have been trained and are part of his clan, basically. But I mean, these kings have just laid waste to four people groups, two territories, and then other kings who have been in rebellion. It's amazing to me that God uses a little guy like Abram to take down the big guys. Although as I was studying, I'm like, that's kind of a theme for God, to use the little guys to take down the big guys. And that's what we see happen as Abram attempts a rescue of Lot. Now, how did Lot get where he is? I would say, and we need to reflect on this for just a moment, how did Lot get to be where he was? By a series of small steps. I mean, last time Abram knew anything of Lot, Lot had just decided to go live among the cities on the plain, right? That was the last we had seen or heard anything of Lot in the story. But I would say that Lot, in the time since then, has taken a series of small steps. Now, if you've ever cared for a small child, you know that small steps, while slow and plodding, will still get you where you intend to go. Right? If you've ever held on to the hands of an infant just learning to walk and they're bobbling around, you know that you're going to be bent over for a long time and moving at what feels like a snail's pace. But eventually, those small steps will still get you where you need to go. Or maybe you have taken children or grandchildren when they're pretty young and not big walkers yet, and you decided it's a good idea to take them to an amusement park, perhaps even Disney, and you realize they don't quite have the stamina, and they slow down, they go slower and slower, and walks that should take you 3 to 4 minutes take you 15 or 20 or so, depending on how many times you have to stop to use the restroom on the way there with your small children. But small steps will get you where you're pointed, the direction that you're going. I think what we see in Lot is that he took a series of small steps. Why? Because last time we heard in chapter 13, we were told that Lot pitched his tent where? Near Sodom. Now, did you notice the slight change in the text for today? Where did it say Lot was? In Sodom. So initially, Lot looks at the lush place and the cities on the plain. He says, I want to go there. And he kind of is on the outskirts, flirtation with Sodom. He's not in, he's just nearby. It's not that big a deal. It's really not that dangerous. That's where he starts himself, is right there on the edge, on the outskirts, maybe in a suburb of Sodom. Right? That's kind of where he starts things. But eventually, because of small steps, he moves to be inside. I wonder what that migration looked like, don't you? What did it look like for Lot to just move a little closer, and then a little closer still, and maybe just a tiny bit closer until eventually he's not on the outskirts of this place that we know to have levels and levels of wickedness. He's actually right there in the midst of it. And I think it's easy for us to judge Lot. Oh, tisk, tisk, Lot, how could you? I mean, you left Uncle Abe, you left the promised land entirely. You decided to pitch your tent near this city, and then you progressively, little by little, step by step, got drawn right into the middle of it. But I think if we stop and reflect for a moment, we probably realize that we may be quick to judge him, but our experiences with sin are often very similar to Lot's experience with Sodom. I'm sure that many of us don't wake up one day and decide, you know what, I'm going to turn my life completely 180 degrees. I'm going to forget everything I've always known and believed, and I'm going to start in this new, entirely different direction. Most of us don't think or act that way. But we do what I would call creeping, little by little, just a bit at a time, something that seems not so dangerous, maybe even enticing or exciting from a distance, and we creep slowly, slowly, slowly. But in the end, often, if we continue those little small steps, we will find the same thing that Lot found, because creeping will lead to captivity. Creep closer and closer, just one little step at a time. It doesn't seem any more dangerous or threatening, because you're just taking little steps, but eventually, if you get close enough to sinful circumstances, influences, whatever it might be, you might find yourself in a place of captivity, very similar to what Lot experienced. So now Lot is being held against his will by these kings. And Abram decides, when he hears about the news, that for the love of family, he will enter into the fray. Don't forget, he's living under the great trees of Mamre. He's where he's supposed to be. He's in the promised land. He's built an altar. His life has a rhythm of worship to it. And so he gets this news that his nephew, his beloved nephew Lot, don't forget, someone that he treats more like a son, really, than anything, is now being held captive. I have to believe that Abram also heard about the long line of battles that led up to Lot's captivity. I mean, they were happening pretty close to him in the world, on that king's highway. I have to believe that he heard rumors of this super-powered army that's just laying waste to everything in its path. And I wonder, as Abram would get those reports about what's happening, he could have reacted in any number of ways. I mean, he could have reacted in fear after hearing reports of these actions of a nearby dominant army. He could have moved away. He could have said, God, I appreciate the promised land and the shelter of these great trees, but there's a lot happening nearby, so I'm going to go ahead and move myself a little further away. He could have acted in fear. Alternately, he could have acted in pride. I mean, he's an up-and-coming ruler with 318 people at his disposal. He could have said, you know what? This is a moment for action. I'm going to assert myself in the midst of this area as a powerful force. I'm going to wait to hear about how they just finish some sort of campaign, and while they're at their weakest, I'm going to attack them so I can be the next big dog. Maybe people can pay me tribute. And he could have reacted in fear, he could have reacted in pride, but he chooses neither. Instead, Abram is only motivated by love. When he hears that Lot, his nephew that's basically a son, has been taken away as a prisoner and forced into captivity, that is what motivates Abram to action. I think a lot of times in our lives we live out of those other two things, fear or pride or something in between, instead of being motivated by love as Abram was. So Abram hears that Lot is now held captive, and he makes his move. In doing so, he displays the attitude of an Old Testament character called a kinsman redeemer. If you want to look up more about it, Leviticus chapter 25 kind of talks about what a kinsman redeemer is and does. But here's the short of it. A kinsman redeemer is a close relative who steps in to recover or redeem property or people who have become captive of someone else and have no means of escape on their own. If you're familiar with the book of Ruth, you know that this plays a huge role as Boaz becomes the kinsman redeemer for Ruth. So it's someone who's a very close family relative who sees that there is a need amongst someone very close to them and steps in and says, it is my duty, responsibility to lovingly step in and rescue this person from a place where they are basically held captive and they have no hope of escape on their own. Now, I love moments like this in Scripture because this is one of those little shadows of what's to come at an even greater detail at the time of Jesus. Because ultimately, Jesus is the kinsman redeemer for all of us. Listen to Hebrews chapter 2. Jesus is not ashamed to call them, us, brothers and sisters. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Jesus Christ is your kinsman redeemer and mine. Because we are held captive, we have no escape on our own. There is no way to earn or work your way out of the prison of the sinful condition we find ourselves in. And yet Jesus, as kinsman redeemer, comes in and says, I will act on your behalf. I will rescue you. And he does. And Abram does with Lot. Acts as his kinsman redeemer. But let's not forget this one detail, that Lot voluntarily left Abram's clan, right? It's not like Abram forced him out. This wasn't a punishment or a judgment. Essentially, Abram said, it's kind of crowded around here. Now, if Lot valued being in Abram's clan, being in the promised land, he could have said, no, I need to stay with you. More than anything else, I need to be with you. We'll figure something else out. But he willingly chose to go live among the cities on the plain. I can imagine that it would have been pretty easy for Abram to say something different, to act differently. Matter of fact, I would kind of expect it. I can see Abram just as easily saying something like, what would we call it today? You made your bed, and now you can lie in it, right? You can suffer the consequences of your own poor choices and learn to live with them. Or maybe you're not my responsibility anymore. I washed my hands of you whenever you walked away from me. You're not worth my time or effort any longer because of what you have done. I think Abram could have just as easily said any number of those types of things, but he didn't. And I think it's a reminder to us within this story, one of many things that we learn is that we should never give up on those who are close to us, who have crept away with those small steps and are now being held captive by something, right? Don't give up on them. They are still worth it. Love them, fight for them if you can in some way, shape, or form. At the very least, pray for them because no one is so lost in the depths of captivity that they can't be rescued. No one. And sometimes I think we give up a little too easily. Now, I also want to say, don't put yourself in a relationship that's toxic for you, that's going to lead you into captivity, but at the same time, don't ever give up on the idea that God is still a God who rescues people. So Abram decides to rescue Lot and his kin for the love of his family, but if you read the story the whole way through, sort of hidden there at the end, is proof that for Abram, it wasn't just about family. It was actually about a little more than that. It was further than family. Because Abram stealthily defeats that powerful coalition of kings. We're told that at nightfall, he divides his army, and I can kind of picture him flanking them on both sides, and it says that he routed them. And he rescued Lot's family. And he carried back not only that family that he lovingly rescued, but did you notice there's something else that we're told Abram brings back with him? It says that he brought back the goods. Where did those goods come from? We're told originally in the story when those kings conquered that they took all of the food and the goods of Sodom. Now we're going to learn next week that it's not Abram's intention to take this plunder and keep it for himself. He actually intends to return it to its rightful owner, to the king and to the people of Sodom. See, to rescue Lot and his family and their belongings was something that was probably done out of love and responsibility as that kinsman redeemer type person. I think that would be the motivating factor for Abram, love and responsibility. But when he brings back the goods and the food of Sodom, that's no longer responsibility of any kind. It's extra stuff. Matter of fact, I might even call it grace. And I think we might expect a slightly different response. I think maybe sometimes we're more quick to expect judgment than grace. Because Abram owes nothing to the city of Sodom, absolutely nothing. He has no contract with them to bring anything back. He has no alliance with them. He owes them nothing. And we know from reading the text that this is a city that's absolutely overflowing with level after level of all kinds of wickedness, right? Now, the question we have to ask ourselves is, did Abram know when he was transporting those goods and food back for the people? Did he know what was going on there? Now, we can never know for sure. We asked the same question when Lot moved and pitched his tent near Sodom. Did Lot have any idea? Well, Lot probably learned quickly. And I would make the case strongly that Abram does, that he does know about the people and happenings in Sodom, because it was a long walk back from where he rescues Lot to get back home. And I have to believe at some point on this long journey back home, the conversation happened where Abram says, "Hey, Lot, yeah, Uncle Abe, how were things in Sodom before the whole war thing broke out?" So I have to believe that Abram knew. He knew what was going on. He knew the kind of people and practices that were there in the city of Sodom. And might we expect that he might be a little more judgmental? I mean, would it be such a bad thing if these awfully vile, wicked people just didn't recover because they lost all their goods and all their food? I expect more of a reaction that we find with Jesus' disciples in Luke chapter 9. Very interesting story. Jesus sent messengers on ahead who went into the Samaritan village to get things ready for him, but the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. And when the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked, "Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?" Dun, dun, dun. And what does Jesus say? Jesus turns and rebukes them. "Lord, do you want us to call down fires of judgment upon these people that are so clearly evil, wicked, and vile?" And Jesus says, "No, I don't want you to do that. Not at all." Even though the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were living in deep layers of wickedness, Abram returned what they needed to survive and flourish. Isn't that interesting? That a king and a people that he has no obligation to, no alliance with, and yet he brings back all these goods and food that these people need in order to survive and to flourish. That sounds a lot like Jesus preaching in Matthew chapter 5 and the Sermon on the Mount when he says, "You have heard it said that love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get?" And I always like to point out, in our modern way of thinking, we equate sun with good and rain with bad, like rainy days are dreary and bad. But Jesus is preaching to a crowd of people that are very, very rural and depend on the fields for their livelihood. So when he says, "I give sun to the good and the bad and rain to the good," those are all good things. The sun and the rain, they're all good things. He's saying, "I shower down my sun on the just and the unjust. I give rain to the righteous and to the unrighteous." And so I think it's a reminder that Abram, in step with Jesus, rejects this binary view of the world where people are easily divided into camps of good and evil and then receive reward and punishment accordingly. All right, binary is this idea of ones and zeros. Binary code runs just about everything that you have that is computer-oriented, whether it's a desktop or a laptop or a tablet or a cell phone or some other device I don't even know about yet. It's all ones and zeros operating down there at the lowest scale, on and off. Very simple. Put things into this category or that category. And we tend to really like this way of viewing the world because it's simple and it's convenient. These people are good, and therefore they deserve reward. These people are evil, wicked, and vile. Therefore, they deserve punishment. But both Abram and Jesus say no. That might be a simple and easy and convenient way to view the world, but it's not the proper way to view the world. There is a bigger way to view it, and it's the way that Abram viewed it when he brought back to the people of Sodom the goods and the food they needed to survive and flourish. It's the same way Jesus looked at the world when he preached and said, God sends the sun to the righteous and the unrighteous, the rain to the just and the unjust. And so I have a few questions for us to chew on as we finish up our time together to kind of apply this to our lives. We don't just want to listen to the word, we want to respond as well. Here's the first one. Has your life been creeping towards sin, even in very small steps lately? And I want to invite you to weigh your heart today. Ask God, you know, pray that prayer. Lord, I open my heart to you. See if there's any way within me that is against you and lead me in the way everlasting. Maybe there's something that's weighing on your heart that the Spirit will convict you of today, that you have been taking small steps in the wrong direction. I want to encourage you today, right now, turn around before you get too far away and you find that you are now being held captive. Secondly, take these few moments of silence and pray for a family member or maybe a close friend who you have seen wander away, maybe with those small steps, but now they're in the midst of some sort of captivity to something. Pray for them today. Again, no one is beyond worth. No one's beyond value. No one is too far lost in captivity. Pray for them today. Fight for them. Love them. And then lastly, reflect on what ways you may tend to hope for the punishment or maybe the demise of sinful people or sinful groups of people, and ask God to shape your heart in order to see them as he does, as Abram did, bringing back the goods and the food for Sodom, as Jesus did when he preached that sermon on the Mount. So take a moment or two to pray if you want to close your eyes or bow your head or just read through those words on the screen, and then in a moment or two, I'm going to go ahead and close us with prayer.